This is another iRaw podcast.
If we love, they love. If we hate, they hate. And historically, people have been very, very open about attributing negative emotions to non-humans, but not the positive ones, you know? Mm. And you know, somebody, you know, do dogs enjoy, you know, somebody said to me, well, we really don't know if dogs enjoy playing. And I said, well, I'm glad I'm not your dog, number one. And I really mean that. And number two, they seek it out. They do it indefatigably. They stop and do it. Animals, non-human animals, don't seek things out that they don't like, just like humans typically don't.
Welcome to Season 2, Episode 2 of The Animal Turn. In today's episode, I speak to Mark Beckhoff about the concept of cognitive ethology. Mark is a professor emeritus of ecology and evolutionary biology at the University of Colorado. He's published 31 books and won many awards for his research on animal behavior, animal emotions, and compassionate conservation. His most recent books include Canine Confidential, Why Dogs Do What They Do, and Unleashing Your Dog, a field guide to giving your canine companion the best life possible. Mark is a well-respected scholar and a former Guggenheim Fellow, and it is a great pleasure to have him on the show today. I think that the aspects that Mark speaks about with regards to cognitive ethology really build well on some of what we spoke about in episode one with phenomenology, where phenomenology helped us to understand how we could even begin to think about experience from another's perspective. Mark starts to talk a bit about the practical components. What kind of observations could one do to understand another's perspective and experience? And Mark also points to why this is so important and why the questions we ask and the language we use when doing so is really important. I hope that you enjoy this episode. Welcome to The Animal Turn. Firstly, I just want to say a huge thank you for agreeing to be on the podcast. It's a real big honor and privilege to have you in the second season.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for your kind invitation.
I've been following you a little bit on Twitter, actually, and I saw not too long ago your response to Ontario Bill 156. And then I started falling down a rabbit hole of some of your work, I do that all the time. And I'm in awe of you being here. And before we get started, I'm sorry to do this. I know it's not the most professional thing in the world, but a friend of mine at Queen's University is like your biggest fan. Her name is Siobhan Spearin. And when I told her I was interviewing you, she said to me, I had to say hello to you on her behalf. So hello from Siobhan.
Hello. My pleasure.
So Mark, at the beginning of every episode, I like to ask people how they came to be interested in researching or understanding animals. What's your story? How did you come to research and understand animals?
Yeah, well, my story probably started when I was about 2 years old, because I was born in Brooklyn, New York, and there weren't many wild animals. There were birds and mice and some rats, but I just felt a natural affinity towards them, and I would talk to them and seek them out, and my parents were very open about letting me do that. And no one in my family was surprised by what I have wound up doing, if you will, for many decades. And my house was very compassionate and peaceful, so I think that my mother's compassion and my father's optimism were critical in my turning out either for the better or the worse, I suppose.
And what was your academic journey like? So you have always had a love for animals. How did you find that there was, you know, something worth researching or studying or learning about here?
My academic journey is anything but linear. I wasn't really a good student, although in high school, and I never knew why. I mean, maybe I did, but I couldn't articulate it. I didn't want to dissect frogs or pith frogs or dissect worms. And then as an undergraduate, I went to classes. I was not a really good student. I ran track in college, and I had been a pretty high-end alpine skier. So sports were really big for me. But then I really kept being drawn to the animal scene. And to get out of the draft in America, I went to grad school, and then I went to a PhD MD program. And then when all the things with the draft ended, I quit because I really didn't want to be indoors. I really wanted to be an ethologist. So I went to Washington University in St. Louis as an undergrad. And then while I was gone, a man named Michael Fox showed, just coincidentally. And I saw that and I wrote to him and said, you know, I graduated from Washington University a couple of years ago. I'd love to be your graduate student. He was beginning a graduate program in animal behavior. So that's really my journey, but it wasn't linear at all. My first job out of college was selling rock and roll records. I just didn't know what I wanted to do. I needed to make some money. But I think through that, there's that arrow of real wanting to study animal behavior in as non-intrusive way as possible. That would be the best way to describe it. And then Jane Goodall was an influence on me, and she remains a good friend and colleague, because when she was studying the chimpanzees and naming them and giving them personalities, I was doing the same with the coyotes, wolves, and dogs I was studying. Mm-hmm. And I got the same junk, if you will, from some of the professors in the department that said, we don't name animals, and we don't know if they have personalities, and we don't know if they have temperaments, and we don't know if they have feelings. And I went, oh my, I'm glad I'm not your dog. But I never doubted that.
Have you seen a big change since that time when you and Jane received so much resistance to naming or accepting that these different animals had emotions? Have you seen a swing in people's willingness to listen to those ideas now?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was slow because back in the 70s, Donald Griffin, who was a member of the National Academy of Sciences in the U.S. and an award-winning biologist, wrote a book called The Question of Animal Awareness in 1976. And I had met him, and people thought he was nuts that here's this hardcore, you know, real empirical, hardcore experimental biologist writing about the evolution of consciousness. And at some of the early meetings where he talked, people really thought that he had lost his mind. I mean, people were really not friendly to him, but I loved it. So he was a big influence on the field of cognitive ethology and animal cognition. And I think afterwards he wrote a book called Animal Thinking, and then followed it up in the early 90s with a book called Animal Minds. So it's been slow going. I mean, there's no doubt about it. And when I started studying play behavior and looking at the emotions involved in play and how dogs and wolves and coyotes and other animals communicated play and would attribute emotions and empathy and theory of mind, there was still some resistance, but I just really persisted. I mean, not only me, but there was a handful of people, because back in the 70s and 80s, there weren't really many ethologists in the United States. I mean, it was a real European endeavor with Conrad Lorenz, Nico Tinbergen, and von Frisch, who studied bee language. And so it was a real European discipline, and the early ethology congresses were predominantly European and held in Europe. But there was always something missing to me when people would take a real behaviorist, Skinnerian, black box view and try to explain everything, in terms of stimulus-response relationships. And it wasn't lost on me that most of the people doing that studied rats and mice in cages in labs, or chimpanzees, or, you know, non-human primates in cages. They never went out and did field work. So they never really could appreciate what wild animals really did and had to do to live in the wild. So this
takes us quite nicely to the focus of today's episode, which is on cognitive ethology. And you mentioned ethology a few times there while you were speaking. But perhaps before we dive straight into the focus on cognitive ethology, you could tell us what is ethology? For those of us who have never heard this word before, what does it mean and how is it related to cognitive ethology?
Well, I mean, ethology, people used to say ethology is the study of animal behavior following Konrad Lorenz. I mean, it's basically the biology of behavior. And it would be looking at questions such as why have different behavioral phenotypes evolved? What are they good for? And Konrad Lorenz used to say that behavior was something that an animal has as well as something an animal does, and that natural selection could operate on different behavioral phenotypes. Mm-hmm. And then Tinbergen came along, Nico Tinbergen, who Lorenz shared the Nobel Prize with von Frisch. And he had four areas that he would highlight that any studies of behaviors should focus on: evolution, adaptation, causation, and ontogeny or development. So you're basically asking questions of why did a particular behavioral phenotype evolve? What was its adaptive value? What caused it? And Tinbergen was concerned with internal and external causes, maybe neuro and hormonal mechanisms, as well as environmental stimuli or environmental cues. Mm-hmm. And then development, because one of the things that's fascinating are individual differences. You know, a lot of people are members of, you know, I call them the P less than 0.05 club. You know, they discount the quote noise in the system, but it's really the individual differences and the individuals who don't follow particular trends that have already or have always been of interest to me. Comparative psychologists, on the other hand, will study a whole array of animals and then try to come up with evolutionary explanations, which really don't hold. I mean, things have changed, but mm-hmm. you know, they compare, you know, invertebrates to amphibians, reptiles, fishes, birds, and mammals without paying any attention to evolutionary lineages, for example.
Okay.
So, yeah.
That's so ethology is primarily looking at or concerned with observations, but are these observations that are both taking place in the lab and in the field, or is there a particular location in which people are thinking through animal behavior and biology?
Well, they can take place both in the field and in the lab. And, you know, one differentiation would be of ecological relevance. So no, Tinbergen and other field ethologists, I've done the same, have done, you know, pretty interesting experiments in the field, but, you know, non-intrusive, number one, and number two, ecologically relevant, meaning that the experiment really has something to do with the way in which individuals adapt to, say, their social groups and their physical environs. And so, you know, rather than watching, you know, a handful of mice in a cage running a maze, I mean, I guess it's interesting stuff there, but, you know, unless you can really tie it into something that wild mice do, it doesn't really mean anything.
So could you give us an example of a type of wild experiment that you've done that was, you know, exactly what you were speaking of there, that was looking at and considering the animal's experience and wanting to understand that as opposed to some sort of arbitrary measure that we were trying to do in a lab that wasn't really related to the animal's lives at all?
Yeah, I haven't done a lot, but I did a long-term, maybe 10 or so year study of vigilance or anti-predatory scanning in birds who lived around my house in the mountains outside of Boulder. And, you know, the question was, how do these animals respond to and detect different predators? And it struck me that there's a lot of studies that showed that birds in a group would alternate, like I feed with my head down so I can't see predators around, and then you scan, and then you feed and I scan, mm-hmm. and which is really interesting. But no one had ever looked at the geometry of a group and how that would influence scanning rates, which is a purely biological question. It's an evolutionary question. And so we manipulated groups by putting food out in certain patterns and noticed, for example, that when birds were in a circle and they could see one another, their scanning was more coordinated than when they were in a line. So when we put food out on a railing, you could, if you were at the end of the line, you could only see one near neighbor. And if you were in the middle between two individuals, you could see two of them. But if you were in a group of seven, you wouldn't be seeing the other four, you know, discounting you and your neighbors. So that was just, you know, an experiment. Another one I did it's been called the Yellow Snow Study. Despite what people were writing years, not so long ago, you know, whether dogs had any sense of self and whether they could differentiate their own urine from the pee of other animals. Over five winters, I moved yellow snow, if you will, and showed that, in fact, they do respond differently to their own and other dogs' urine. And it wasn't a mind blower, but no one had ever really shown it. And we tried to do that with wild coyotes, but it was difficult to do with the wild coyotes. And we realized that by doing it, we were influencing, or we thought we might be influencing their behavior, you know, because it's wild animals and didn't need humans running around trying to deposit scent or move scent. So those would be it. But other studies, you know, predatory studies of predator-prey relationships, flying models over groups. I mean, Tim Bergen did some, he was a master of, if you will, relevant field studies. So getting back to that notion of ecological relevance, I think is really important that people are really trying to learn about behavior patterns as phenotypes and adaptations that allow animals to be cod-carrying members of their species.
So this kind of brings in some interesting ideas, though, because you speak about behavior, and immediately I think a lot of people would say, well, this is just instinct. It's not any sort of thought-out behavior. You know, a dog knows a different dog's pee smell because it's important to maybe mark territory. It seems like we have these already predetermined narratives about what this means. And it's just instinctual. There's no sort of decision-making or thought processes that go into these behaviors. What do you think about those types of arguments?
Oh, I just think they're utter nonsense. I mean, just absolutely nonsense. I mean, 100 years ago, we knew that animals were thinking and feeling beings. There are certain behavior patterns that animals need to do correctly the first time. So like responding to alarm calls or anti-predatory behaviors, you know, you only get one chance. And so those could be hardwired. But there were some really classic studies done. A guy named the late Jack Hillman, who was just a wonderful animal behaviorist ethologist. He did a study in the 60s called the Learning of an Instinct. And if you think of that, because, you know, people think instincts are unlearned, but herring gulls, a baby's peck at a red dot on the mother's beak. And that dot is called the sign stimulus. And it releases the, if you will, what people call the fixed action pattern of baby herring gull pecking for food. But, okay, so it's hardwired, you know, in the sense that the dot's there, it evolved for a reason, and then, you know, the young bird has to eat, and the mother wants to feed her child, and so that evolved. But then Hillman showed that depending on where the dot was, the speed at which the mother was moving her bill, and the arc of the bill really influenced the pecking behavior of the mother's child. So there you go. So the one mistake people made was that the word innate or instinctual or inborn meant unmodifiable. But even Lorenz had written a book about, you know, that just wasn't so. So I don't know anybody today, literally not one person, who would ever try to argue that, you know, the behavior of animals is predominantly hardwired, innate, unthoughtful, and unfeeling. I mean, it's total garbage. And now that people are accepting the other views and explanations and interpretations, we're learning a lot more. Because it's easy to say, oh, yeah, it's just hardwired. They don't really think.
Yeah. But do you not think that, so you say, I think you're being very generous in saying that people don't rely on arguments of instinct. And I wonder, though, if there isn't a mammal bias there somehow, because I think, do people view bees, for example, as having sort of individual decision-making powers, or is there still kind of a divide when we think about insects versus mammals or birds? How does ethology deal with those kinds of differences, or they just, how do you look at that differently?
Well, you study them, and people should stop making pronouncements about the behavior of animals who either they've never observed or never studied or haven't been studied. So, when you look at the vertebrates among fishes, not fish, fishes, because fishes have unique personalities. You don't talk about mammal or bird, you talk about mammals and birds. So if you look at fishes, we're learning amazing things about their cognitive abilities, the fact that they feel pain, the fact that they respond to endorphins and morphine the way humans do. And so it's easy to write them off because they don't look like us or they don't have expressive faces. So I'd say a good card-carrying ethologist would simply say, well, before you make these pronouncements that animals can't do something or don't do something, why don't you study them? And that's I really mean that. I mean, I studied dogs forever, and I've written two recent books, and I've got another one in press. And when I read some of the things people write about dogs, I'm thinking, really? I mean, like dogs live in the present. They don't live in the present. I mean, they've got great memories. They've got they anticipate future events. And they don't have personalities. Well, if you've ever rescued a dog who's been abused, damn well that dog has a history and an autobiography that influences his or her present behavior.
What's so interesting is actually, I think what you're showing is how important language is when we speak. So we could both observe perhaps exactly the same animal, but have a different vocabulary for explaining what we're seeing. You throughout this interview so far, you've used words that perhaps don't come up in a lot of books when we speak about animals, words like mother and child and history. What other words are really used when cognitive ethologists try to understand the relationships between different animals? And what are the importance of using these words?
Well, you refer to animals as who or whom, not that, which, or it, for example. Because they're not objects, they're subjects. They're sentient. And even if they're not, they still have a life, for example. So those would be, the adverbs you use, for example. The mother-child thing is huge because a lot of scientists will talk about their young or the offspring. And I'm thinking they're their children. And from an ethological point of view, some of the most amazing adaptations have developed in, say, the mother-infant. It could be the father, depending on their mating systems. But the mother-infant relationship. And so, Harry Harlow did those horrific studies where he separated the young monkeys from their mothers and found out the young monkeys didn't like it. And number one, I mean, what a dumb thing to do. And number two, what I don't even know what the word is. What a dumb thing to assume. I mean, an ethologist would tell you that you've got all these behavior patterns that have really, they're highly evolved between a mother and her child. And so I've started just talking about mothers and childs, the same in mating systems. You've got wives and husbands. And people go, well, you only use the word wives and husbands and children for humans. Well, why? No, it makes no sense to me. You know, the other words would be, you know, people say we're going to euthanize or sacrifice or cull animals. You're killing and murdering them. They'll go, well, murder is only reserved for humans. And you go, well, why? And the answer for a lot of these questions, of course, is that it's in the legal systems. But seriously, and I'm not trying to be frivolous about it. I mean, but seriously, when you start thinking about a mother coyote, I mean, I knew a mother for 4 years in the wild, and she was a better mother or as good a mother as many human mothers. And she loved and protected her children. And she was with the same male for at least 4 years. So we used to just talk about husbands, wives, and families. And the more people use those words, the more people will become more sensitive to the fact that these are sentient, conscious, thinking, emotional beings.
Mm-hmm.
And there's nothing, I mean, there's nothing false about it. I mean, the falsity is when people talk about the female that had offspring. And I'm going, really? And of course, you know, when you go back to what Jane Goodall did with her early chimpanzee studies, where she had the F group and the G group, and, you know, those were the individuals she was naming, you know, Flo, Fido, Feigen, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Of course they have names. They're individuals. But one of the reasons, of course, a lot of scientists, especially those who torture animals, don't want to name them is they number them, because a name means that you've got some identity or some relationship with an identified individual. So back to your question, things are changing. I mean, I had a big argument with somebody and I just said, you can't publish this paper if you don't call them children. And she said, okay, you know, and I, you know, like I said, I wasn't trying to be obstinate or a jerk about it. I just said, how would you like me to call your babies your young?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I think, I mean, it does show a different relationship. On the one hand, you're showing a relation. I think many of these words imply what the relationship is, whereas some of the others, like young, are quite sterile. Young to who? So they evoke different emotions in us, perhaps because we can relate to them better. But then, so in the first episode for season two, because season two is focused on animals and experience, I tried to understand the concept of phenomenology. And one thing we spoke about a fair bit was, well, how can you know? How can you know what these animals are experiencing? If it is love, if it is friendship, how can you know what it is you're observing?
Watch them. I mean, just watch them. I mean, my goodness gracious. I mean, when you see a mother protecting her children, or you see a mother endangering herself to protect her children, watch two animals court. Watch them work hard to develop a relationship. I mean, I mean, you know, I've been doing this for a really long time. And, you know, if we love, they love. If we hate, they hate. And historically, people have been very, very open about attributing negative emotions to non-humans, but not the positive ones, you know. Mm-hmm. And you know, somebody, you know, do dogs enjoy? You know, somebody said to me, well, we really don't know if dogs enjoy playing. And I said, well, I'm glad I'm not your dog, number one. And I really mean that. And number two, they seek it out. They do it indefatigably. They stop and do it. Animals, non-human animals, don't seek things out that they don't like, just like humans typically don't. And so watch them, you know, and don't be afraid of thinking that these animals experience their emotions in their ways. So dog love may not be the same as human love or chimpanzee love, but it doesn't mean that they don't have it and we do, or vice versa. But that's, yeah, anyway, I don't want to keep going on because I think it's the dumbest thing in the world. It's the debate, it's kind of quieted down, but there was a debate, do animals really have friends? And I'm thinking, I mean, seriously, in my book, Canine Confidential, I said it was the most absurd thing I've ever heard in my life. I mean, if we have friends, they have friends. you know, and you can look at dogs at a dog park, or you can look at wild animals seeking out individuals with whom they want to spend time. They're not seeking out predators. They're not seeking out animals who are going to beat them up. They're seeking out individuals with whom they bond and have a good time and enjoy being with and feel safe. So
I read a really interesting study not too long ago. I forget the details, but I think they were trying to understand whether cows made friendships. And what they ended up doing was just monitoring which cows hung out with which cows.
Yeah, right.
And they found quite distinctively that there's preferences across different families. It's not just, you know, mothers and daughters hanging out. You've got people, cows that enjoy particular cows' company, and they will hang out. And you've got some cows that are not liked by any of the other cows and are like outliers. So that was really an interesting way of showing you spend time with those you like, which was a really elegant way, I think, of making the point you are here. And something I know you've spoken about before, and it's in line with this. You've spoken about Darwin's, evolutionary continuity? Is that what it's called?
Yeah.
So is that kind of the thinking you're using here when you're saying, if we have it, they have it too?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, Darwin argued that the differences among various animals were differences in degree rather than kind. So they're quantifiable, mm-hmm. not qualitative differences. So, yeah, I mean, a general bumper sticker could be, if we have it, they have it too. But, you know, of course, you've got to then look at the particular animals about whom you're talking. But sure, I mean, it's just basic, good Darwinian, if you will, evolutionary biology. I mean, it isn't rocket science. And now, like I said before, in answer to your question about, you know, individuals of different taxa, I mean, we're learning a lot about fishes, and we're learning a lot about invertebrates, and we're learning about birds, and you know, of course, mammals. And, you know, the more you look, the more you find. It's just people just didn't hesitate to show species. You know, it's called speciesism. Well, mammals do this, but birds can't possibly do it. And you go, really? Has anybody ever looked? Or have you ever read about what fishes can do?
And so if you're gathering all of this information and you're learning so much about different species, different individuals, different relationships by observing them, and perhaps this is just a technical question, but what would then be the difference between cognitive ethology and ethnography?
Well, I don't know, because people have called me an ethnologist. And it's been, it's usually a typo. So in some ways, I've never really spent much time thinking about that. But in some ways, it's like we're anthropologists who are studying non-humans, if you will. I mean, we're going into a different culture, speaking a different language, communicating in different ways. And we're trying to step into their lives and figure out why in the world they do what they do, or how do they do certain things. So I think it's very similar. Like I said before, the problem is people don't spend enough time just watching animals. I mean, they just watching. When my students worked on a number of projects with me, they had to spend as many as 50 to 100 hours just literally watching the coyotes, just watching. No notes, no cameras, no nothing. Just to form what we call an ethogram, an ethology, which is just basically a menu of the different behavior patterns that the animals perform.
That's amazing. Wow. What would you say for folks like myself who might never have the opportunity to watch coyotes? I mean, I'm guessing I shouldn't now be seeking out opportunities to go and watch. You know, there's maybe something to be said about me not invading the space of some species and the space that they still have left. So how could I learn about these types of behaviors or be more discerning about what I'm reading with regards to animals and how their behaviors are being described to me?
Well, no, I mean, that's a big problem. But one of the things that's available now for people, I'm hooked on, like, you know, the Planet Earth and Blue Planet and Frozen Planet and Smithsonian shows. And so you have the BBC, Smithsonian shows, public television. There's so much out there. And that's one of the things I've done. In fact, I've done it with some of my friends' kids. We just watch them together. Sometimes we turn the sound off and they just watch like a litter of African wild dogs or a bunch of penguins and just write down or talk about what they're doing. So there's, you know, there's plenty of opportunities for sure.
And if you're open to watching.
I'm sorry?
If you're open to watching, there's plenty of opportunities.
Oh, I think there are. Yeah, I mean, you know, I mean, there's nothing better than a good documentary. I mean, I'm amazed. I shouldn't say really amazed, but I am amazed sometimes at how good some of them are, how they really, really capture real behavior. You know, there's this great series I've been watching on, it's on public television here, but I know it's plays elsewhere, called Animals with Cameras. And sometimes it's live animals, but the ones I've been watching have been like putting cameras in penguin nests and in stuffed birds. It doesn't change the behavior at all, and seeing what they're doing. And there was one recently of a camera that they put in a pile of elephant dung, and then they put a camera in a rock, and they put a camera in a model of a bird who lived around the elephants. And there you've got, if you will, a bird's eye view of what the elephants do. And it's exactly what ethologists do, just watching and recording. And if you can do non-invasive, you know, experiments that are ecologically relevant, then you can really learn a lot.
Is there something that through your observations, you know, you should keep in mind when watching a particular animal? I know that you've spoken about different sensory experiences before. What does that mean? If I need to be sensitive to the different sensory experiences of animals?
Yeah, I mean, in a practical way, it means like when we were studying coyotes, and I've done some work on wolves, you know, that they communicate using scent. And so it sounds funny, but, you know, you're in the field all day, you got to go to the bathroom, and you remind both, you know, all your field workers, don't go pee where the animals go. I mean, seriously, or don't carry food, you know, if you're going out to check something around a den, for example, or to check something in the animal's home range. So, you know, don't make sounds. We painted all the cameras and spotting scopes that we used dull black, so there wasn't a reflection from the sun, for example. So it's really making... Or watching the animals and then getting a feeling for whether you're changing their behavior. So that's what I meant. We would just sit and watch them and see what they do. And then it got to a point after, you know, a while where we could just show up, walk into the field to our observation sites. And the animals, in this case, coyotes, but sometimes wolves, would just kept doing what they were doing, you know, so... We just assume we weren't really changing their behavior. And so that's really the window into how the animals live when you pay attention to the smells and sounds and visual stimuli to which they're sensitive.
So, you know, you speak about coyotes and dogs, for example, experiencing the world more through smell and being sensitive to smell. And there are some, and this kind of takes me back, unfortunately, to the question earlier on with, I don't experience the world through smell. So earlier on, you had said, for example, that I should just watch and be sensitive, because if I do it, they do it. But if I'm using my experiences as a baseline, is there not potentially a whole world of experiences that I'm not being sensitive to, because I'm not really thinking about how this different animal maybe uses smell differently or literally senses the world differently, smell or sight or touch. How do you sidestep that? Is it just biological training? Do you just learn more about the animal's body?
Well, you're not sidestepping it. You're paying close attention, actually. So scent marking patterns, for example, or glandular secretions that animals put out. You see them do something. You see them orient. They're intentionally depositing a scent or pee or something. And then you look at the responses of the recipients who come by and sniff them. Sometimes they ignore them. And then you can learn a lot about the messages that are contained in these different chemicals or pheromones, they call them. So you're not bypassing it. You're actually paying close attention. And that's the other thing is, you know, when you're studying birds, the birds I studied, but, you know, you're studying birds or you're trying to learn how coyotes or even dogs communicate using vocalizations, you make sure that you don't interfere in their vocal channels, for example. So you're very quiet for, you know. But see, to me, just the being there and the studying these animals and learning how to observe them in the least intrusive way possible means that you are entering into their world. You're not leaving scent odors, either, you know, pee or, you know, Coca-Cola or some drink or some sandwich somewhere. And you know, when you study these animals, when I lived in the mountains, I had bears right at my door and cougars, and you leave a wrapper out that you think has no smell, and there'll be a bear there in no time flat. So,
and like you said, we kind of intuitively know this already when we go to provincial parks or we go to, you go to any park, really. You're sitting next to a lake and you're having your lunch and all of a sudden you've got some pelicans that are nearby that are very interested in what you're doing because they've watched you and they've smelt what you're doing. So what about these situations? So you've spoken about animals where you've gone into wild spaces, and obviously the distinction between wild versus human is fraught with a whole bunch of tension. But you've gone into a wilder space and you've watched animals. What about animals that are in urban areas? Is there space and room to observe them? Should we be paying attention to the animals that are part of human communities?
Oh, we should be paying close attention to them, and this, you know, there's really no good upside to this pandemic, but, you know, more and more animals are coming into towns and taking, if you will, over or living in the areas that we stole from them. And so, yeah, I mean, I had some kids in North Boulder watching a family of foxes playing not too long ago. They had seen some foxes where they lived. There was a little park and some, if you will, wild space around their house. So in the mornings, they would just go out and they'd watch. It's pup time. There's young foxes. You know, you got mom, dad, and their kids, and they're out playing and hunting some. And so we should be paying very close attention. And a hope for me would be that as people who don't typically see these animals see them, they'll become more compassionate and empathic to all animals. So I think it's an upside, if you will, to a horrific situation. Okay. One story I can tell you is when I studied penguins in Antarctica, and there were some animals who had never seen humans before, they would look in one colony, they just kind of looked at us and just kept doing their thing because they were used to either aerial predators, in the form of South Polar skuas, basically predatory birds, or leopard seals or killer whales in the ocean. So there we are sitting and watching them. And I mean, we used to joke, they'd go, you know, they in the bubble in the penguin's head would be, you know, who are these? You know, we're wearing our warm clothes and we sit in with these things, you know, binoculars basically, and reading in, you know, notes to a tape recorder. But they just they almost showed zero concern, and there was no reason for them to be concerned because the only land predator they really had were these skuas who were aerial predators. So a lot of the adaptations that penguins evolved were centered on aerial predators, not land predators. And the predators like leopard seals, they were down by the beach in the water, and killer whales are in the water. So that was a really, it was a really interesting thing for me that, you know, here we are walking around and trying to be non-intrusive, of course. And it's like they were still doing penguin things.
I think it's really great how you've just shown the like two very different relationships with humans and also the sensory experiences of animals there. Because in the case of the animals and the foxes in the urban areas, you know, the first thing that came to mind for me is maybe we need to learn to be a bit quieter. The minute we sort of started to get a little bit quieter, animals started to come out a little bit more. The minute we slowed down a little bit and made room and space, so they experience our busyness. They experience our noise. And on the other hand, what a beautiful example of the penguins not really being exposed, not really having a relationship, a direct relationship with humans, and you being there, starting to forge one, them sussing you out, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't feel we've had any relationship with them, to be honest with you. I mean, I never felt that. I mean, you know, there were sometimes, you know, when they were, if we were observing and they went back to their Adelie penguins form, nests out of stones, and they engage in stone stealing, and it's a real ritual. And they'll steal rocks from their neighbor's nest and carry them back to their nest. And sometimes we would be just sort of looking at these animals and trying to figure out what in the world they were doing. And it was like we weren't even there. I mean, it was like, oh, well, there's this tall thing there with a red parka, but big deal. I mean, he's not trying to, you know, they're not trying to steal stones. They're not interfering with our feeding the young. They're not interfering with the greeting ceremonies that these animals perform when one member, the husband or the wife, come back from sea. So we were really non-entities.
But you did have a relationship with them. They are the researched and you are the researcher. So maybe over time, the more researchers that go, they start to develop ideas about you. They might not be nefarious or bad ideas, but surely this is still a relationship that's forming, even if it's...
I suppose. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I can't answer that question. I think with the coyotes, yes, that we were very careful. We'd arrive at around the same time early in the morning. We'd oftentimes just wear the same clothes from day to day because there was no reason to wash them anyway. But we would sit quietly. There were no reflections from the cameras. And you can imagine, you know, the coyote saying something, it's just those humans who want to learn about what we're doing. And mm-hmm. and in reality, they really couldn't afford to change their behavior very much. I mean, they had kids to raise and they had to get food and defend food and get, you know, a home range or a territory and defend it and watch out for predators, you know, who could take the babies. So, I mean, you know, they, over time, you know, we would do some little tests to make sure that we were not influencing them. So yeah, I mean, you could call it a relationship, but I never really thought of that in terms of a relationship other than it was a relationship that, you know, about which we were really careful so we weren't changing their natural behavior.
Okay. It's interesting because I guess I come from a background. I'm not actually an animal studies scholar. Well, I am slowly, hopefully becoming one. I'm at the beginning of my own career in this, but a background in sort of gender studies and critical studies where you start to question the role of the researcher and how you could impact. So it's interesting then to think through the difference between a lab and a wild environment where you're controlling an entire environment in a lab versus what you as a cognitive ethologist are doing here, trying to be, like you said earlier, a lot more like an anthropologist. And yeah, I just think it's interesting to think through what kind of relationship that is, and possibly, are there animals out there that deserve to not be observed? Is there anything, because you've, throughout the episode, I think rightfully so, said we should be watching animals to learn more about animals so that we can better protect them and respect them. But is there an argument to be made for not watching animals, for leaving them be, for not going in their spaces?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really important question. Yeah, and so we need to learn about them to protect them. I mean, a lot of the data we collected on coyotes, for example, the data are used to protect them. So you do it in as non-intrusive way as possible. Or learning about animals who, you know, we're killing off. You know, we live in what's the Anthropocene, the age of humanity, and I call it the rage of inhumanity, because we're just destroying violently other animals and their homes. So yeah, you could make that case. And I think that it's a very reasonable case in some instances. But in my own research, I really like to apply what I learned to protecting them if they need protection. So, and I think that, you know, in some ways, the field of conservation behavior, for example, is very, centers a lot on developing different conservation protocols and making different conservation decisions based on what the animals need and the way they, say, fulfill their needs, for example.
Mm-hmm.
I like just walking out of my front door, you know, and seeing a black bear hanging out by my study, which was a separate building. I didn't get to meet them up close and personal. I was happy they were there. But I learned a lot about these red fox behavior, which is very similar to wolves and coyotes and dogs, by just watching this family of red foxes over 5 years. It was the same mother, the same wife, and their children. Some left, some stayed. We used to laugh. They just went around their business as if we weren't there. And after a while, like the dogs on the hill, there were six houses and each house had a dog. The fox didn't even pay attention to the dogs. And there were some instances of baby foxes trying to play with dogs. And there was never, you know, there was never an injury. There was never an altercation. Once again, what I said before, I think it's really important that people, they want to write about animals and think about animals, then they need to look at the animals as who they are. And, you know, you learn, there's wonderful studies of wild rats and wild mice, and maybe watching mice in cages run mazes or do something can give you information about how they live in the wild. But to me, the fascinating question, once again, or questions would be, how do they adapt to their wild niches, to their wild environs, and how do they live out there among all the other non-humans and humans, of course?
These are all great questions. And I think I could talk to you for ages and just listen to the decades of stories you've accrued. I have one maybe final question before we listen to your, you've got a quote ready, and then we'll round off the episode. Just one last question, because you mentioned conservation there, and it got me thinking about the tension between individuals versus groups. Uh-huh. and how you kind of navigate that in your research, and what maybe advice you have for up and coming cognitive ethologists about thinking of these individual fox families and these quite intimate relationships that are happening on quite a small scale, and kind of the rhetoric and language that's being used in conservation, that's speaking about entire ecologies, entire ecosystems. How do you navigate that kind of tension in your work?
I don't have any tension. I mean, I'm a real fan of compassionate conservation. First principle was first do no harm. The second would be the lives of every individual matter, and then strive for coexistence. So I don't have any tension about that at all. I think killing should be off the table. I don't think we should be trading off the lives of members of one species for members, individuals, if you will, of another. I don't think we should be trading off the lives of individuals of one species for individuals of the same species. And so, I mean, in all honesty, I don't have personally any tension. Killing's off the table. We just don't need to kill anymore. We've done enough killing of other animals in the name of conservation or humans or in the name of coexistence, which makes me laugh that we're going to kill animals so we can coexist with them. Mm. Well, yeah, you can coexist with their corpses if you want. So no more killing. And people can go, that's unrealistic. Well, it might be for some. It's not unrealistic. I'm not one who likes to say something can't be done and then just roll over on my back like a submissive little human and say, okay, well, it's okay to kill this species of owls to save these owls or cormorants to save salmons or kill some wolves so that other wolves can live somewhere else. So that's
so if you were faced with the contention of an invasive species that's challenging a whole ecosystem, none of the supposed invasive species are at fault. They didn't choose to be there. They were introduced of no fault of their own, such as, you know, the toads in Australia. A lot of people would call for eradication, to get rid of them, destroy them, and the whole ecosystem will be fine. Your starting point would say that's not an option. We can't start from a place that has killing as the beginning point.
Well, no, I mean, look at New Zealand. New Zealand has a brutal murder incorporated like slaughter fest going for invasive animals using 1080 and traps and snares, the most inhumane methods ever. And the fact of the matter is it's not really working. And the fact of the matter is they're killing a lot of natives because the techniques they're using are not specific. And even if they were, I wouldn't be for it. So, yeah, I mean, we bring animals in one way or another. Sometimes we bring them in because we like them, and then we decide we don't like them because they're pests. So we murder them. And that's really, that's just terrible. So the other thing from an ecological point of view, and biological point of view, is that, like, if you have invasive animals, and I don't even like that word, but call them non-natives for now, they become part of the ecosystems. And ecosystems are dynamic, evolving entities. So when people say we're going to kill the invasive stoats or possums or mice or rats, and then the ecosystem will go back to what it was, that's just hogwash. Ecosystems aren't going back to what they were. Because you're removing animals who became part of the dynamic of an evolving ecosystem. So, for example, the wolves who are in Yellowstone now, after they were reintroduced 25 years ago, they're there and it's a successful program, blah, 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 blah. But the point is, they have not gone back and recreated the ecosystem of the Yellowstone National Park in 1925 when the last wolves left. And that's really important to recognize that, you know, you're not recreating an ecosystem. You're removing animals or placing animals into a evolving ecosystem. And so, yeah, from a compassionate conservation point of view, the non-natives are sentient. They feel pain, and we shouldn't be causing them pain. And put your collective brains together and start using non-lethal, humane methods of control. So the murder, the bloodbath, they don't work. I mean, that's the thing. So, you know, and so even if, like I said, for me, even if they did work, they're off the table. And that's where I come in. And if there was a vote on a certain board or something, I would just vote against the killing. We don't need any more killing. Isn't there enough killing in the world? And I really don't, I mean that seriously from my heart. Mm-hmm. Aren't we just killing enough beings in the world that we don't have to go out and kill more in the name of conservation or in the name of humans? Because that's what it comes down to.
Yeah, or economy. I think that always ends up being, you know, the economy will suffer if we don't. And it's not that it's a flippant concern. You know, we're seeing right now how important it is to sustain economies and ensure that they are thriving. But I think you raise a really, it's about what our priorities are, what is put at the front of the line when we think about what we should do. And perhaps the ease with which we decide killing is the solution. And I think what you've spoken about today in talking through animals and their experiences and starting to actually view them as beings with lives and experiences, that starts to become a very problematic solution indeed.
I also ask people, would you do it to your dog? You know, I do a lot of work in China and people go, how can you go to China? They eat dogs and cats there. And I'll go, well, I just came from America where they eat goats and pigs and sheep and cows. Mm. And so, I mean, I know there are reasons, but you know, I mean, these wild animals, these quote non-natives, they're no less sentient than your dog. So we need to ask hard questions and we need informed answers. And what you just said is so right on the mark in the sense, it's just so easy to kill. It's just so easy. It's just, it's heartbreaking. It's so easy to kill not only non-humans, but humans. And so we need a paradigm shift. I believe compassionate conservation is a good paradigm, is a good beginning to a paradigm shift, and it's not going to happen overnight. So people are going to have to stop getting used to getting a gold star on their forehead for something that they do and gets rewarded immediately, because it ain't happening that fast.
Yeah.
Anyway,
and do the bits you can.
I don't want to go on and on, but I'm not going to change my tune.
No, thank you so much. It's really refreshing to have someone speak their mind and say what needs to be said in many regards. You know, even in our conversation now about invasive species, it's very easy to forget how some supposedly invasive species we've accepted. You know, cows are not indigenous to North America or to either of the Americas, and arguably are one of the biggest ecological disasters. They are not the ecological disasters. Humans' use of them are in terms of what it's doing to the lands across the Americas and across the world. But we don't frame them as being invasive in the same way we would toads or mice or rats.
They make a lot of money for people. I mean, that's why wolves are being killed in, say, the state of Washington now. It's, you know, Defenders of Wildlife still says, we don't like the killing, but they haven't said no killing. So Defenders of Wildlife are really defenders of livestock and cows.
Mm.
I mean, it's what you're saying is really prescient, because cows make money. You know, the other thing that you were saying before, you know, which is really a fact, is that, you know, the detailed studies that have been done show that coyotes and wolves, for example, don't really, I mean, yes, they're predators. Yes, they eat cows and sheep and other animals who could make money. So it's wrong to say they never do, you know, they never practice their natural predatory behaviors and instincts. But the fact of the matter is, the studies that have been done show that predation doesn't come close to doing damage such as poor husbandry, if you will, and care of the animals.
And arguably what we're talking, again, bringing it back to the ideas of experience, that we kind of really get swept up in these conversations about economy and what benefits and doesn't benefit humans, but to think about these wolves and these cows and these coyotes and to think, well, what are their experiences in the current economic structure? How do we start to think from below? How do we start to say, okay, and maybe below and up is not the right word, but how do we see from another's viewpoint or sense point or whatever it is, and what would that mean for changing the world? Which is, I think, what you're saying here is we've got to start changing the world and doing it day by day.
We change the world because each individual life matters, because they're alive, because they've got what people call inherent or intrinsic value, not their economic value, not whether they're pretty or shiny or colorful or they produce melodic songs. They are alive and they deserve to live.
Awesome. I agree with you. Do you have a quote to round off the episode? Something from another scholar, from one of your books that you'd like to share?
Well, I do, and I'll just read it. It comes from it's evolved from a book I wrote called Rewilding Our Hearts. And since I'm really very much into using what we know on behalf of other animals so that we can make positive differences in their lives, it's morphed from the 8 P's of rewilding to the 12 P's. And the 12 P's of rewilding are being proactive, positive, persistent, patient, peaceful, practical, powerful, passionate, playful, present, principled, and proud.
Wonderful. I think that's a great way to finish this off. Be peaceful, patient, and proud. Those are the three that stuck with me there. Thank you. Thank you so much, Mark, for giving so generously of your time and your thoughts and ideas. If people are interested in learning more about your work or want to learn more about what's involved in cognitive ethology, perhaps you've got a grad student that's thinking, wow, this is what I want to do with my life. One, where can they find out more about you and your work? And two, do you have any resources that you would point them to when thinking about cognitive ethology?
Yeah, they could go to my homepage, which is markbeckoff.com. I write regularly for Psychology Today, and they can go through, I think I've written 1,300 pieces for them.
But,
it's really a compendium. I really enjoy doing it because, you know, the other side of this conversation, Claudia, is getting the word out to the masses, not just the people, academics and researchers. So I love writing books for them as well as writing for Psych Today. They could email me. I have a Google group, an animal cognition, animal emotions, and compassionate conservation group to whom I send stuff. It's not a discussion group. It's really an information group. And I've got a number of people. I mean, I find stuff on my own, but I've got a number of people scattered around the world who send me stuff. So, if they have specific questions, they can email me.
Great. Well, I'll put your details up on the podcast page to make sure that people have your website information available if they want to get in touch with you for any of that. But on that note, thank you. If there's any, do you have any final words or are you ready to say goodbye?
No, this was great. Thanks. We've covered a lot of ground. And I really honestly, from a personal and heart view, don't view the world as black and white, but I really do view decisions about animal use and animal slaughter and murder as black and white, in the sense that we can do better and we really need to do better.
We can do better and we need to do better. That's a good way to finish off. Thank you again. Have a lovely afternoon. I think it's approaching evening there for you. Have a lovely evening and I look forward to talking to you again soon.
That sounds good. Thank you very much, Claudia, and thank you to your listeners.
Once again, a huge thank you to Mark Beckoff. As always, thank you to Animals and Philosophy, Politics, Law and Ethics, Apple, for sponsoring this podcast, to Jeremy John for designing the logo, and to Gordon Clark for the awesome bed music. If you'd like to connect with me, you can find me on Twitter at Claudia F. Town, that's TOWNE, or you can connect with the podcast directly on both Twitter and Instagram with the handle at The Animal Turn. I look forward to connecting with you then. This is The Animal Turn with me, Claudia Hertzenfelder.
For more great iRaw podcasts, visit iRawPod.com. That's IROARPOD.com.